In certain areas of Chicago and around the state, neighborhoods are struggling as pharmacies close left and right.
Access to medication and those vital flu shots for folks who are used to just walking up to this store is not an option anymore.
That's Melvin Thompson, a community activist from Chicago's South Side, talking about the city's pharmacy deserts with the Chicago Tribune. We'll talk more about pharmacy deserts and new technology that might help some communities across Illinois with more access. Plus, the price of Bitcoin keeps going up and down by the minute. But what is Bitcoin again? And is it really a viable way to invest your money?
I feel, well, I could probably, since I know the technologies and know a lot more insights, I think I could probably just speculate, buying low and sell it high.
And we continue our series of interviews with candidates for Attorney General. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. When a computer programmer with a pseudonym started a new currency called Bitcoin a decade ago, it was supposed to be a way for people to buy and sell goods without using the financial system we are all used to. But it's also become a way for people to try and make a little money. And over the past year, Bitcoin has drawn headlines for just how quickly it can rise or fall in value. If you think the fluctuations in our stock market over the past few days have been something, think about this. A month ago, one Bitcoin was worth $17,000. Yesterday morning, it was worth just below $6,000. And this morning, it's back up to about $8,000. There's a good chance that number is going to change even over the course of this conversation. So what is Bitcoin and blockchain and all these terms you've heard thrown around, especially in the past couple of weeks in the headlines? Thankfully, we have Shannon Liao with us on the line from New York, where she's a tech and culture reporter for The Verge to help us explain this. Hi, Shannon. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Shannon, we should start off by saying that Bitcoin is just one of the many cryptocurrencies that are out there now. First, can you explain what a cryptocurrency is and how Bitcoin fits into all of this?
Yes, of course. So cryptocurrencies, also known as virtual currencies or digital currencies, are just peer-to-peer payment systems. It's the way for people to sometimes anonymously trade, value to each other for goods and services or other kinds of purchases, and they can also use them sort of like stocks to profit a little, as you mentioned before.
So how do you actually buy Bitcoin?
So you can go to, there's like a really, the most popular Bitcoin or cryptocurrency exchange known as Coinbase, or there are another, any number of exchanges that people use to buy Bitcoin, and they buy it into their digital wallet where they hold these virtual coins.
And how is the value of Bitcoin determined? I mentioned how much it's fluctuating.
Right. The value of Bitcoin, it's actually determined by the number of people investing in it, the market capitalization, just the demand for Bitcoin, and also it also depends on the Bitcoin miners. So another way to obtain Bitcoin is through mining it with your computer. And so your computer would do algorithms and solve math in order to get the Bitcoin. And as the number of Bitcoin miners increases, the difficulty of mining Bitcoin also increases. So there's a limited amount of Bitcoin out there, but that determines the supply of Bitcoin. So it just has to do with how many people are buying and selling Bitcoin, and also how many people are actually making it available through mining.
And I wanted to ask you whether you think Bitcoin now is still mainly in the realm of the very tech-savvy. I was reading that Washington Post story that came out a couple of days ago. It started with a gentleman in Kentucky who had made like $700,000 off of Bitcoin last year. Is this becoming more mainstream?
Yes, I would say so. I would say Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies are becoming more mainstream, especially just Bitcoin itself. I think people at their dinner tables over the holidays were talking about it. People who are not really knowledgeable about where Bitcoin came from or what it is are actually paying attention just because of how some people have actually profited off of it. And also, you know, there was a story a few weeks ago about the rapper 50 Cent and how he had allowed people to pay him in Bitcoin for his album back in 2014. And because he had received $400,000 in cryptocurrency back then, and he forgot about it, now the money became worth $8 million. So he just got rich accidentally without understanding Bitcoin technology or blockchain technology.
Okay, so 50 Cent made $8 million off of Bitcoin. As you're listening, by the way, to our audience, if you have questions or comments, you can tweet to us. Our handle is 21SGShow. If you want to give us a call, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. But again, our Twitter handle is 21STShow. That's Shannon Liao. She's a tech and culture reporter with The Verge. I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation. Xiaoyao Chen lives in Champaign-Urbana. He's a graduate student in computer science at the University of Illinois, also a Bitcoin user who's here with me in our Urbana studios. Xiaoyao, welcome to the 21st, or welcome back, I should say. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
So you bought Bitcoin about a year ago, but you've been interested in it for a couple of years, right? What made you decide to take the plunge into buying it?
So, yes, I've been following the Bitcoin and also other cryptocurrencies and also the blockchain, the technologies that goes behind it since 2014. But I didn't invest until like last year because I see like the price of Bitcoins along with other cryptocurrencies were just soaring so quickly last year. And I just feel like, well, since I'm familiar with the technology, since I know some of more of the insights behind each of them, it could make sense that I invest a little bit and speculate or like buying low and sell high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So Shannon, Xiaoyao mentioned blockchain technologies. Can you explain what that is?
Right. So blockchain technology is actually this open public ledger where because Bitcoin is decentralized, so it doesn't rely on a government or any kind of company to monitor it. It relies on blockchain. On the blockchain to monitor, you know, who has made a transaction, who has paid for it, and then approves each transaction on the ledger. So therefore, it can be timestamped, and there can be accountability for somebody paying, and for somebody receiving a transaction.
And so, Xiaoyao, were you paying attention to that also, kind of looking, tracking the currency? What made you finally decide to say, oh, now I'm going to invest in this?
Well, there are a lot of, like, since last year, there are more and more new cryptocurrency projects that is coming out. Some are really interesting. Some are really innovative. You know, they are trying to solve some particular problems using the blockchain, to transfer values in a trustless environment. Some others, on the other hand, are kind of like scam projects. They are not legit. So, with these projects coming out, and they were doing like ICOs, basically their initial coin offering. They are trying to try to create their own coins.
Yeah, so instead of an IPO, it's an ICO.
Exactly.
So okay.
They're trying to sell their coins in order to do the fundraising. And those tokens or those coins will just go to the market, they'll go on exchange, and their price will just go up quickly.
So how much have you invested? Or in the past year, how much did you invest?
So in the past year, I've invested a couple thousand in a portfolio of cryptocurrency, including Bitcoins, and I've made almost doubled.
Wow, so you've doubled that almost. Or have you almost doubled it or more than doubled it?
Almost doubled it.
Wow, okay. And so you go to these meetups, Xiaoyao. There are several meetup groups in central Illinois. What is that like? Who goes to these groups and what do you talk about?
So these meetups are usually held by, some are held by like investors, some are held by cryptocurrency enthusiasts, and the one I go to is there are normally like 50 to 60 people present, and there will be a schedule of speakers, and the schedule usually covers an introduction to Bitcoin and Ethereum, which is another like very popular cryptocurrency, and then there will be some other speakers introducing their project or their ICO project, or it may be some new mining techniques. And the specific one I went to will sometimes invite some academic professors.
Well, I was going to ask, so what are you studying at the University of Illinois?
Computer science.
Are most of the other people there also people who are studying computer science or in the tech or engineering world, or no?
Not really. There are some students, but others are just people who are generally interested in the cryptocurrency world.
Yeah, Shannon, to bring you back into this, as we hear Xiaoyao talking about the people who are coming to these meetups, he and I were actually talking before we went on air about how many more people he's seeing at them and how many more people are interested. I wonder why, if you have an explanation for why you think this is becoming more common. Is it because people are simply seeing they can make more money? Do you think it's because of a lack of trust in our financial system? What are reasons or why people are telling you they're getting involved in Bitcoin?
Right. So the people I've spoken to, in general, many of them have seen the rise of the value of Bitcoin over the past year, especially in December 2017 and the beginning of January. And they were attracted to the rise of the price of Bitcoin. And also just because everybody started to discuss it more and it became more of a hot topic. So that also drew interest. Some people just want to get involved in this new kind of way of investing. They're interested in finance, but this seems to be the most innovative and more likely to take off kind of technology. Some people have likened Bitcoin to, you know, like the dot-com boom in the mid-1990s. And while many of those dot-com companies actually crashed, some remained successful, and the people who invested in those became very rich. So there's this parallel to those days as well.
Right. And I mean, I guess then that also kind of begs the question, right, Shannon, is this too good to be true? Because I think people hear about, like Xiaoyao telling us how much he doubled his money. There are people who have lost a lot of money, too, we should point out as well. And then there are also scams out there, right?
Yeah, there are a lot of scams. Actually, you know, there's the U.S. Commodities Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC. They actually cracked down on three different, fraud schemes in January, and there are way more out there. A lot of companies have been switching their names to include the word blockchain in their name, but they're not actually cryptocurrency companies, and they're just incorporating that to draw more investors. So there's a lot of fraud, a lot of schemes going on out there just to take advantage of the growing interest. So people should definitely be careful.
Yeah, Xiaoyao, when you started first getting involved with this, how did you find out if it was legit? Because it's not like you can go to like a bank or they're listed on a stock exchange to know how to trade with it or how to buy and sell things, right?
Yeah, and to decide if a project is legit or not is kind of hard, because you have to you cannot only like look at the team members behind the project, or you know, if the legal documents are there. You have to like dig deep into their white paper, which is a paper that describes their technologies, and see if, you know, their writings make sense. Are they copying their contents from other wares? Yeah, and do they have like real implementations or not? So these are the criteria that I usually use.
And so you're trying to check and see if they're actually mining, like if they're actually doing the correct calculations also.
Necessarily mining, but
not,
like...
Okay.
But like, are they really bringing out a new idea that makes sense, or are they just, you know, just making up things?
Right. And so then the way it works, Xiaoyao, is that... For you, then they are those companies, or the way you're buying and selling Bitcoin, those are then linked to other exchanges that are then connected to actual financial institutions. So that's how you get your Bitcoin back into dollars?
Yes, exactly.
Okay. And so do you have advice for people, Xiaoyao, if they're interested in doing this? What would you say to them?
For investing in Bitcoin?
Yeah.
I'll encourage people to know about to like get more knowledge about Bitcoins, because obviously it's like been a hype for these years. But the more knowledge you have about you know, blockchain in general and other cryptocurrencies, you'll be more confident at evaluating, you know, different projects. And also it's I know a lot of people like lose their Bitcoins or lose their other cryptocurrency during the process when they, you know, are using it. So it's definitely helpful to know the best practices of how to keep your coins safe.
Right, because if you lose it, Shannon, if you lose it, there's no way you can get it back, right? Shannon?
Right. So if you lose, right. Can you hear me?
Yep,
right.
Go ahead.
So if you lose, So if you lose the login information, the credentials, the access to your Bitcoin wallet, it's just, you know, it's taken over by whoever has control of your wallet now, or it's just left there in, I guess, on the internet without being able to be accessed by you.
Right. Shannon, we just have about a minute before we take a break here. Do you have any quick advice for people as well? As Xiaoyao was saying, this sounds pretty complicated, frankly, but I wonder what advice you have for people who might be interested in getting involved with this.
Right. So at the moment, the price of Bitcoin has fallen. It's fallen to 8,000, as you mentioned, perhaps lower to 7,000. So as it keeps falling, that might be a better time to invest. Of course, I can't really give that kind of advice. But, you know, as it rises and becomes more popular, that's kind of when Bitcoin is too pricey to invest in. And also to be more careful about the risks, the SEC has released a lot of documents. There are a lot of great sources out there on the web that people can research in order to be more careful about the companies they choose to invest in.
Yeah, we'll have some links to that on our website at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Shannon Liao and Xiaoyao Chen for being with us. Thanks, guys.
Thank you.
The 21st is supported by the University of Illinois Press, presenting a public history exhibit in the north-south corridor of the University of Illinois Main Library throughout the month of February, with highlights from a century in publishing and design. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. For some parts of Illinois, sometimes it seems you can't go a block without passing a Walgreens or CVS. If that's true for you, count yourselves among the lucky, because for other residents in Illinois, it can be a challenge to find a drugstore. That's right. Just as we talk about food deserts, there's also the problem of pharmacy deserts. Here's James Marshall talking about a neighborhood on the west side of Chicago where he's seen several pharmacies close down.
The pharmacy closed up right there on Madison and Kesey, and when it closed, it was harder for me to get medication. And then when it closed that one, they turned around and closed the one down the street around there on Grand, so it was nowhere closer to really get it at. And it left us none to go to at all.
Again, that's James Marshall speaking to the Chicago Tribune in a story they did about pharmacy deserts. University of Illinois Professor Dima Cato has been studying this problem in Chicago on the city's south and west sides with the goal of getting patients access to the resources they need. She's on the line with me now. Professor Cato, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Maybe you can explain to us first. I think people have a clear sense of what a food desert is. What is a pharmacy desert? How is that defined?
So it's a very similar definition. A pharmacy desert is a neighborhood that lacks adequate access to a local pharmacy.
And is the issue that pharmacies aren't open at all, or that they're open and then they're shut and now they're shutting down?
So there's two issues, really, and they're kind of related. There are fewer pharmacies in some communities, so they're not opening as frequently. But also that when they open, they end up closing. So it's a problem of pharmacies not opening or not locating in certain neighborhoods, making them pharmacy deserts. But also when they do open, they're more likely to close in those same neighborhoods.
So I wonder if this is a little bit different than the food desert issue, because when we talk about food deserts, it's just normally access to quality food, right, to fresh foods. And when we're talking about a pharmacy desert, does it mean there's simply not any, there's no access at all?
So it's not that it's no access necessarily. It's more difficult access. So proximity or distance to the nearest pharmacy is further. So it takes residents of those communities a longer time or have to travel longer distances to get the prescriptions filled at a pharmacy, whereas in other neighborhoods, you know, it could be, like you said, you know, it's very difficult not to go to the pharmacy because they're all over the place. So it's an issue of not having access to any pharmacy at all, because pharmacies in general, you know, are pharmacies because they can dispense prescriptions to the community. And if you don't have one, you really can't get your prescriptions filled that easily.
How did you, I know you were at UIC's College of Pharmacy, how did you first start studying this issue? What made you want to be, what made you interested in this?
So I was really, initially I was interested in looking at access to medications, access to prescription medications specifically, and how, getting a better understanding of why certain patients, particularly low-income minority patients, are less likely to use medications for chronic disease like hypertension and cardiovascular diseases than whites, and kind of at the national level. And one thing we found in our research, and many others have found too, that it's not just because of insurance. It's not because prescription drugs are costly. Even after Medicare Part D was implemented, we see that disparities or kind of a difference between blacks and whites or Hispanics and whites still exists. So there's this gap in access to medications for that persisted even after we made them more affordable, particularly for the elderly population. So I was curious, well, you know, maybe it's because they're living in neighborhoods that make it more difficult to fill the prescriptions they have. It's not about insurance, it's not about income, it's not about, you know, all these other factors that we usually kind of think about when we think about disparities in access to care in general. So that's really the motivation behind understanding pharmacy access at the community level. And that motivated our initial project published a few years ago that looked at pharmacy deserts specifically in Chicago. And as expected, we did find that there are indeed fewer pharmacies in black neighborhoods on the south side and kind of more predominantly Hispanic neighborhoods on the west side than there are in the white neighborhoods in the city.
That's Professor Dima Cato. She is at UIC's College of Pharmacy. Of course, we know this isn't just an issue in Chicago. There's many communities around the state that don't have enough pharmacies or they have a lack of competition when it comes to that. Joining us now from Paxton, Illinois, in central Illinois, is Andy Hudson. Paxton's a city with no chain pharmacies, and so Hudson's Drugstore, which has been family-owned for almost 70 years, provides lots of crucial services. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the 21st.
Hello, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
Andy, how far, and I should mention you're on the line from the pharmacy, how far are people driving to your pharmacy? How far away are your customers coming from?
We serve a radius of probably 20 to 25 miles. So we have a lot of people drive from that distance to our pharmacy.
Wow, that's pretty far. And do you also deliver to people as well?
We do. So we've expanded that service over recent years. And in our town of about 5,000, of course, there's a pharmacy here. But what we see is in towns that are smaller than that, and we have some maybe towns of 1,000 or less that we deliver to, that they don't have their own pharmacy. So those people have to drive. So our delivery service helps with them, and especially the elderly population, where especially this time of year when there's snow-covered roads, it's much harder and dangerous for them to drive that 40-mile round trip to the pharmacy.
And Andy, I wanted to ask you, I mean, I think people think of a pharmacy, they think of people filling medication. What other things do you all do at your pharmacy apart from just delivering medication or fulfilling prescriptions for people?
Sure. Well, as pharmacists, we'd like to think that it's a lot bigger picture than just putting pills in a bottle and giving it to them. We have an educational perspective, too, where we teach people how to take their medication and why it's important and talk with them about what side effects they're having and how to mitigate that. Also, we provide other services like immunizations. We gave out over 700 flu shots this past year, and we also provide packaging services for people that maybe have a hard time remembering to take their medication. We have a multi-dose robotic packaging service where it puts all of their morning meds in one package and all their noons and all their evening meds in a different one, so it helps their compliance to help ensure that they're taking their medications correctly.
Professor Cato, as Andy's describing all this, I wonder what role pharmacists play in health. And as Andy's sort of describing all the different things he do, when there isn't that person or that pharmacy there, what kind of outcomes are you seeing?
So, I think that's a great question, and just highlighting the fact that pharmacies are not just dispensaries, or they're not just giving out, you know, prescriptions to patients. They're providing a whole slew of services, including, you know, counseling, right, the basic services the pharmacist should provide. And increasingly, a lot of pharmacies are also providing some of the preventative care, like immunizations. A lot of them now, at least chains, include clinics, right? So if you can imagine not having a pharmacy conveniently accessible, whether 10 miles is convenient or whether half a mile is convenient, it makes it difficult for patients, particularly older patients that are on a lot of meds, that are very sick, to stay healthy, to take their meds, to be adherent. And that could have consequences on community health and across the state. And it's interesting that independents, we found, are by far more likely to try to make pharmacy access more convenient by offering things like home delivery. We found in a national study that we did that across the board, at least, you know, 2/3 of independent pharmacies are offering a home delivery service to their patients. So it could make it easier to get their scripts. And part of that is because most of the time these independents are located in areas that may be more rural or less population dense.
Right, independent stores, Andy, like yours, like Hudson's. I wanted to just ask you one last question about, we've been talking about access, but I also wonder what it's like, what choice there is. What is that like when it comes to where you can fill certain prescriptions with certain insurance plans? Is that an issue as well?
It definitely can be, and we're seeing that more often where we have chain pharmacies that are buying up basically the prescription processors, and then they're funneling the patients to their pharmacy. CVS recently purchased Aetna, so that's a fear in the rest of the pharmacy community that they're going to have closed networks where even if we wanted to participate, they're not allowing the patient to come to our pharmacy. They're requiring them to go to CVS, so now they have to drive from Paxton 10 miles, CVS is not delivering to Paxton, so it doesn't sound like a lot, but for an elderly person on a lot of medication, that can definitely be a challenge. So,
yeah. Well, Andy, we know you've got a busy job you're doing from the pharmacy, so we'll let you go, but thanks for joining us. That's Andy Hudson with Hudson's Drug Shop in Paxton. Thanks for being with us, Andy.
Thanks again for having me.
Professor Cato, as Andy is mentioning that, I wanted to just ask about sort of the financials of this. What does it look like as we sort of have the big chains, the CVS, the Walgreens, of course, started here in Illinois? How has that landscape of consolidation changed access for people?
So I think what Andy was referring to is really these preferred pharmacy networks or narrow pharmacy networks that have increased over the last 5 or 7 years, where patients have, in order for them to pay, kind of have a lower copay, they need to get their scripts filled at a certain pharmacy. And for the most part, these pharmacies are chain pharmacies. So it makes it very difficult, one, for the patients to, in terms of affording the medications, but also for independent pharmacies to really survive if a lot of the patients that they were used to filling scripts for now are leaving to another pharmacy. So it's difficult financially for a pharmacy to, you know, maintain or stay opened. In terms of the landscape, the pharmacy landscape, I think the distribution of pharmacies really hasn't changed over time. And we found that the number of pharmacies per capita hasn't changed since 2007.
Okay.
You see change is kind of where pharmacies are going, kind of their distribution geographically. Even the share of independents has been kind of pretty steady at a third to a little over a third of all kind of community pharmacies in the country, and the same for chains. There are about 40% of all pharmacies in the country. So that really hasn't changed. You just see kind of where they're locating that's really shifting around.
And Professor Cato, do you have a sense of possible solutions for this as they're shifting around? There are places that open and then close pretty quickly. How do you see this issue being resolved a little bit better?
Right. So I think when you look at where the community demographics of the areas where pharmacies tend to close, they share certain characteristics. One is that, you know, a larger share of the population either has Medicare Part D or Medicaid. And that has to do, so when you think about the reimbursement rates for pharmacies, it's much higher when a patient has private insurance or commercial insurance. So one potential solution is that, you know, you increase prescription reimbursement for Medicaid or Medicare. That could make it more profitable for pharmacies in these areas that serve a disproportionate share of Medicaid patients to survive so they don't end up closing. I think another, so some states are actually doing something similar. The state of Illinois isn't, but I know Oregon State and I think Washington State and maybe the state of Ohio have Medicaid policies where they base their reimbursement on kind of the location of the pharmacy. So if it's in an area that's underserved or if it's the only pharmacy within a 20-mile radius or whatever, I think there's varying definitions of that. They kind of increase their reimbursement.
Right. And I wanted to also ask about how role technology can play in mm-hmm. all of this. And I wanted to bring someone else into the conversation. Adam Chesler is with Telepharm. They're a national company based in Iowa City that allows pharmacists to work remotely. He's actually on the line with us from Dallas. Hey, Adam, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So how does Telepharm, you have locations across Illinois, where are they and how does it work?
So we don't actually own any of the locations. What we do is provide software to enable pharmacists to open telepharmacies throughout the nation.
And what is a telepharmacy?
Good question. There's a ton of definitions for it, but mainly a telepharmacy is remote supervision of pharmacy technicians. So it's allowing the pharmacist to expand their reach in areas that they couldn't previously get into because of cost constraints.
Right. So we know in Illinois, you guys have Telepharm is working with people in Decatur, near Tuscola, and Atwood in the Chicago suburbs like Berwyn. How is this more of a solution for people in more rural areas or other underserved areas?
It's a great solution for a lot of these rural areas. The population in many of these rural areas isn't high enough to support a full-time pharmacist on staff. So this really enables them to put that pharmacy in town, have the pharmacist be able to reach into that town. The pharmacist would still do every step of their pharmacist clinical process, but now they can have that access in their town instead of having to drive a long distance.
Right. And Professor Cato, I just wanted to ask you, as you hear about like things like telepharmacy, are those also ways that people are there other technological solutions like this where people are working to try to increase access?
So I think building off of kind of the home delivery model, making access, you know, going to the patient as opposed to the patient going to the pharmacy, I think telepharmacy is pretty novel in that the patients could still use the pharmacy. They might not have access to a pharmacist on site, but they can communicate with a pharmacist, and I think that's important. So that's a technology solution that uses and leverages, you know, pharmacies or expanding pharmacies within kind of community health centers or clinics where you know patients are leaving with a prescription, but you also know maybe they won't fill it. And in ensuring patients do fill and adhere to their prescribed regimens, you know, having a pharmacy on site, which many clinics, for example, or community health centers that are in underserved areas lack, you know, you can have now like a kiosk or a dispensary that maybe it's difficult to afford a pharmacist, but you can afford technicians and be able to deliver the service effectively to improve patient care.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it at that because I'm afraid we're out of time. But I do want to thank Professor Dino Cato for being with us. She's Assistant Professor of Pharmacy Systems, Outcome and Policy at UIC's College of Pharmacy. I want to thank Adam Chesler as well with Telepharm. Both of you, thanks so much for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nyla Boodoo, and this is the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. We're continuing our series of interviews with candidates for Illinois Attorney General. There are 10 folks vying to take the place of Lisa Madigan. She's not running for re-election. The primary is on March 20th. In the interest of fairness, I'll explain how we did all of these interviews. We tried to make it like a job interview where we asked everyone almost the same questions, and we recorded everything in advance so no one would get the questions ahead of time. Today, Erica Harold is an attorney in Champaign-Urbana. She ran for Congress in 2014. She also serves on the Illinois Supreme Court Committee on Equality. You may have also heard she was a former Miss America. She's running against Gary Grosso for the Republican nomination for Attorney General. Erica Harold, welcome to the 21st.
Thank you for having me.
As we mentioned, you've run for office once before in a primary race against Congressional Representative Rodney Davis. What inspired you to run for Attorney General now?
Being Attorney General is about being the chief advocate for the people of the state of Illinois. And my background as a litigator and background standing up for people is something that made me want to seek this position. I ultimately decided to become an attorney when I was in high school. I was the victim of racial and sexual harassment, and that harassment escalated to death threats that ultimately forced me to transfer to a different school. And that experience of feeling powerless and marginalized made me want to become an attorney. And people in our state need someone to stand up for them, whether it's related to public corruption, the opioid epidemic, or so many other issues that are impacted by the Attorney General's office. And I felt that my background and experience uniquely situated me to be a fierce advocate for the people of our state.
We've seen Lisa Madigan join other attorneys general in suing the Trump administration. Do you think part of the role of Attorney General is to take on the federal government?
I think that any time the federal government exceeds the scope of its constitutional power, that it is the role of the Attorney General to stand up against the federal government. But I think the only time that it should be done is when that scope of authority has been exceeded.
What do you see as the main role of the Attorney General?
First and foremost, it's to effectively and efficiently carry out the statutory responsibilities of the office. The Attorney General is responsible for everything from consumer protection to enforcing election law to making sure that charities are reporting the information that they're supposed to, providing a defense for the state when its laws are challenged, and providing defenses in other areas in which Illinoisans' interests are impacted. So first and foremost, it's to do a good job effectively representing those interests. Then you're afforded an incredible bully pulpit to be able to be an advocate for the issues that matter most to Illinoisans. Issues that I will focus on: public corruption, the opioid epidemic, and criminal justice reform. Those are areas where voters throughout the state, regardless of their political background, say that they want to see an advocate fighting for them.
Can you tell me a little bit more about those three priorities and how you would focus on them?
With respect to public corruption, particularly that means ensuring that people do not have to have any sort of political connections when they're doing things such as applying for a job or applying for a grant. We've seen patronage hiring scandals occur within our state government, and the Attorney General has not been as aggressive as I think needs to be in terms of going after that corruption. It also means ensuring that watchdog groups, media groups, and citizens have the proper accountability and transparency that they're entitled to from their government. And so specifically, the Attorney General's office has the Public Access Counselor that ensures that FOIA and the Open Meetings Act is complied with by public bodies. And so the Attorney General can make sure that people are complying with that law and that citizens are getting the kind of government to which they're entitled. As it relates to the opioid epidemic, I think it's important to work collaboratively with stakeholders throughout the state to address this epidemic that's ravaging far too many communities. And I've been talking to state's attorneys throughout our state to see how we can be more collaborative and proactive, whether it's seeing if deceptive marketing is happening, whether people are doctor shopping, whether pharmacies are filling too many prescriptions. There are many ways in which we need to be addressing this, but we need to be working together as a team. And as it relates to criminal justice reform, for the past 10 years, I've been on the National Board of Directors of a group that does prison ministry and advocates for bipartisan criminal justice reform. And I would like to see Illinois address issues such as sentencing, civil asset forfeiture laws, and bail bond reform, and make sure that our criminal justice system gives people the opportunity to have a second chance and rebuild their lives once they've served their time.
I'm speaking with Erica Harold, one of the nominees for Attorney General. She's running for the Republican nomination for Attorney General. You've been outspoken about your views against abortion. If you were elected Attorney General, how would you deal with laws like HB 40 that allow for pay for state workers to have abortions and would also allow for abortions to happen in Illinois legally, even if Roe versus Wade were to be overturned?
Regardless of one's view on abortion, it's the job of the Attorney General to enforce the law. And that should be what each and every person who's running for Attorney General commits to doing, because that's the constitutional responsibility.
You're also the youngest candidate in the race. You have one opponent in the Republican primary. There's a crowded field of eight others who are running for the Democratic nomination for Attorney General. Why should voters choose you?
Voters should choose me because I have strong litigation experience and experience being able to negotiate the kind of deals that are win-wins for everyone involved in litigation. But they should also vote for me because I am a political outsider who brings a unique perspective to the office. We've seen in this state where you have people serving for decades, and those decades of experience don't actually end up in resulting in positive outcomes for voters and residents of this state. And I would use my experience in the realm of criminal justice reform, my work on the Illinois Supreme Court Commission on Equality and the Supreme Court Commission on Professionalism, I would use those perspectives in our legal system to advocate things that would move our system forward. I think regardless of political background, people could agree that our state is losing too many jobs, is having too many of our residents retire places outside of this state. And if we can't reverse that trend, it's going to be very difficult to get back on track. And so I hope that voters will see that I have a record of accomplishment, but a willingness to speak truth to power, regardless of political party. And I think that's the leadership that we need to take the Attorney General's office forward.
Erica Harold is an attorney in the Champaign-Urbana area. She ran for Congress in 2014. She also serves on the Illinois Supreme Court Committee on Equality. She's one of two Republicans who are running for the nomination for Attorney General. The primary is on March 20th. Erica Harold, thanks for being with me.
Thank you so much for having me.
Last week, the state Supreme Court had a big ruling when it comes to gun laws in Illinois. In a unanimous decision, the court found that provisions banning firearms near public parks are unconstitutional. The state added the 1,000-foot ban to the books in 1993 in an effort to curb gun violence prevalent in many public parks. The ruling is in line with others in recent years that have found that the state's ban on citizens from carrying guns outside the home violates aspects of the Second Amendment. It's forcing lawmakers who are seeking tougher gun control laws to rethink their strategy. Joining us now to explain a little bit more of the law behind this is Eugene Kontorovich. He's a professor at Northwestern's University's Pritzker School of Law. He specializes in constitutional law. Professor Kontorovich, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with me.
Pleasure to be here.
So this unanimous ruling came, it was a criminal case of a man who was convicted of having a gun near a park in Aurora, just west of Chicago. The opinion penned by Chief Justice Lloyd Carmier, he wrote that the law is, quote, a severe burden on the recognized Second Amendment right of self-defense. Can you explain in layman's terms for people who are not lawyers what that means?
Yes, the Second Amendment to the Constitution, which is part of the Bill of Rights, provides for individual right to carry firearms for purposes of self-defense. And it's a constitutional right, just like the right to free speech, and just like the right to for free speech can be used sometimes for bad purposes. So, of course, can guns, but it doesn't change its constitutional nature. A decade ago, the Supreme Court affirmed that the Second Amendment does, in fact, contrary to what many states have been doing, give individuals a right to carry guns in self-defense. Now, Illinois has always had amongst the most restrictive gun laws, and a series of decisions and regulations by Illinois and Chicago have tried to interpret the Supreme Court opinion in its most narrow possible terms, and I would say even to interpret it unrealistically and absurdly and attempt to essentially erode or curtail the recognized constitutional right to carry firearms in self-defense. So this law is one such example. The law banned the carrying of guns within 1,000 feet of a public park and many other facilities, not just in the park. And when you put this on the map, that actually covers most places people might go or pass through, and it effectively prevents people from using their constitutional right to carry firearms in self-defense. So the court held that basically they were keeping people from using their constitutional rights.
And so the constitutional right, would this then be because it's a public park? Because the courts have upheld, for example, and correct me if I'm wrong, the fact that you can't bring a gun into a workplace sometimes, like there are signs saying no guns, or into churches.
So the Constitution in general is just about the government. The Constitution limits what the government can do to people. Now, if a company wishes to restrict entry for various conditions, private premises are private and no one has to go near them. But this governed not just public parks, but basically streets, private businesses. It didn't give people a choice whether they could allow guns in those areas or not. So that anywhere around a public park within 1,000 feet, streets, etc., you could not carry a gun. And what makes that different is it's not a private person making a rule for their own premises, but the government making a criminal law and subjecting people to it.
Well, the Supreme Court also found, Professor Kantorovich, that the state had failed to provide evidence that the ban on guns near parks kept children safe. Why was that necessary to do in this case?
There is some idea that in extraordinary sensitive locations, perhaps like schools, where you have which are based on children, the government could be more restrictive. But the court found that a public park is really no different from any other place that people might go or gather, and there's nothing specially sensitive about it. Not to mention that, this rule did not just apply to public parks, but the areas around public parks, which adds up to a lot of space.
So we just have a couple minutes left, but I just want to ask you one last question. In your opinion, based on the way the court is trending, does it seem then that like these types of laws in which guns are prohibited in specific places, will those always be struck down?
Again, they're not always going to be struck down. You can imagine things like public sporting arenas, which are extremely crowded, or schools, such restrictions being sustained. But when it looks like the law is essentially designed to make it difficult for people to carry guns in the ordinary way, because they don't, who knows in their head if they're within 1,000 meters of a thousand yards of a park, restrictions that are really designed to prevent the ordinary self-defense carrying of guns are going to be struck down, and only very narrow restrictions for specific places might be upheld.
Thanks very much. That's Professor Eugene Kantorovich. He teaches constitutional law at Northwestern University's Pritzker School of Law. Joining us to discuss this Supreme Court ruling last week, unanimous decision by the court that it's unconstitutional for firearms to be banned near public parks. Professor Kantorovich, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That does it for us today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android, wherever you can get podcasts. And if you have Alexa and NPR One enabled, you can play us there. All you have to do is say, Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st, and it'll play our most recent episode for you. If you want to follow us on Twitter, search for 21ST Show. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. You can post questions you want us to ask on air as well. On our Facebook page, if you search for The 21st to like us, you can also comment on what we're working on. All of those links, every other way to contact us, if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email. All you have to remember with all of this is just our website, 21stshow.org. That's where we've got all the links and information and directions, by the way, for Alexa. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Grace Stetson is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.